Good morning and welcome to the June 30th edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy, on a sunny week of the 4th of July.
Yeah, good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone.
Okay, so today we're going to speak with Michael Huerta. He is the former administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration. We're going to be talking about the current status of commercial aviation. We'll also talk with Mark Brown and Barry Nan Cohen-Rothschild about the upcoming running of the balls during minor days, and we might even have a special guest. All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned. Commercial air travel has been in the headlines a number of times in recent months, and not in a good way. Here to talk about the status of air travel in this country and the challenges faced by the industry is the former administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration, Michael Huerta. We're lucky to have him with us this morning. Good morning, Michael. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
So let's start by giving the audience just a sense of who you are. Can you share a bit about your background and the career path that led you to become the administrator?
Well, I joined the FAA in 2010, and it was not with the intent to be the administrator. I joined as deputy administrator, and my background was actually in transportation technology and surface transportation. And so at that point, Secretary Ray LaHood asked if I could, as deputy, take over the oversight of some of the programs associated with the modernization of air traffic control. Yeah, it was interesting. I said to him, look, Mr. Secretary, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that working on a mission-critical toll collection system on the New Jersey Turnpike is in the same league as what you're talking about. But he made the point that you understand how to deploy technology in a government setting. Well, fast forward a year and a half later, the administrator resigned, and as the number two, I stepped into the role of acting administrator and served in that capacity until the beginning of 2018.
So go back a little bit. Tell us about the New Jersey Toll Road. What was your career path prior to going to the FAA?
It's a combination of government and private sector, but always in the intersection between the two. I had initially started doing trade work under a USAID project, and that in turn took me to port work, which took me to airport and transportation work. And I worked in the U.S. Department of Transportation under President Clinton, and then was doing the private sector at a firm called Affiliated Computer Services. They don't exist anymore. They were sold to a company. Well, they're now known as Conduent. And we did their electronic toll collection system work. Many people from the East know about EasyPass or about Fast Track from California. That was us. We were the integrator and operator of those systems on the part of our toll authorities. And so when the opportunity came to go back into government, I was really interested in it. I feel a pull to serve and was really looking forward to getting back in. The FAA is a wonderful and incredibly professional organization, and I feel honored to have worked with the great people there.
Now, were you a pilot at any point?
No, that's interesting. That is always the question people ask. Do you need to be a pilot to be the FAA administrator? Only three administrators have actually completed their full term. None of them were pilots. But my background was more technology and management of large government and large commercial operations. And so that was the interest, that I understood how to run a very large organization.
Yeah. Did you have to be nominated by or approved by Congress to be the administrator?
Yeah. I was nominated by President Obama. And as I touched on before, the FAA administrator is a little bit different from most other appointees. I needed to be confirmed by the Senate, but the administrator serves a fixed five-year term. So I had 13 months as acting administrator and then served out my five-year term. And so actually that makes me the longest tenured administrator in the history of the agency.
Congratulations.
So help the audience understand a bit more about the mission and role of the agency.
Sure. Well, the way I like to think about it is government does three things. It serves as a regulator, generally for safety, to make sure that products we buy or services that we take advantage of are operated safely. Second thing is the government funds a lot of things, infrastructure. And then the third thing is there are certain critical systems that the government operates. The FAA is one of the few places in government that does all three of those things. It operates the air traffic control system. It has a very robust airport grant program that airports use for development of runways, taxiways, and so forth. And then, of course, it is the regulator for all aspects of the aviation industry to ensure that it is meeting the critical safety standards that our country expects from it.
Not just safety of pilots, but safety of the equipment they fly.
Exactly. So it's the safety of pilots, it's the certification of the equipment itself, it's the certification of the operation. So the company, you know, do they have proper training protocols? Do they have, the right number of staff to carry out critical functions and so forth? And so it's a heavily regulated industry, and so all aspects of those have standards, and the FAA ensures that those standards are being met. The FAA is also really a player on the international scene as well. You will find that there are many countries that have a regulatory framework or an operating framework that is identical to the FAA. And that is because, I like to think, aviation was invented here. And so it should not be surprising to anyone that as other countries have developed and grown their aviation industry, they've looked to the U.S. as a standard to develop along the lines of.
Yeah. Now, you had mentioned finances for runway construction. How is the FAA funded, and how has that impacted the way it accomplishes its mission?
Well, the FAA is funded largely through excise taxes and fees on aviation. The largest percentage of that are ticket taxes that you and I pay on airline tickets. Mm-hmm. Next are fuel taxes that are charged on aviation fuel. And then there are smaller categories as well. If an airline chooses to overfly the United States, say from Canada to Mexico, they will pay overflight fees. Or if you register your airplane, you pay a registration fee for that. And so, but for the most part, the agency is funded by excise taxes that are charged on the industry. Now, it is still subject to annual appropriations by Congress, which actually doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. In certain years there has been a small general fund subsidy, but I think, a cause for concern across the whole aviation industry is, since it's funded out of a trust fund, those funds should be always invested to the full extent they can be in aviation.
Gotcha.
Okay. So we touched on safety, and obviously you've seen all these stories in recent months about wings clipped on runways and confusion. Is it safe?
Yes, it's safe. The system is safe, and this is why. Aviation is founded on a principle of redundancy. There are many layers of safety, whether it's practices, procedures, technology that is deployed, all across the system. There are virtually no single points of failure in the aviation system, and that's by design. From the very beginning, aviation was always regarded by the American public as something, while it was really interesting, really exciting, it was something the public didn't understand. And so they wanted to ensure that someone was ensuring that it was safe. And that, over time, became the FAA. Now, even though, there is a lot of redundancy in the system, it is a system under a lot of stress. And there are a couple of reasons for that. Well, actually, a bunch of reasons. But during COVID, the industry really contracted quite a bit. And as a result of that, there were a lot of people, professionals in the industry, that chose to retire. When COVID was over, I don't think anyone expected the rapid growth of aviation right out of COVID. I guess if you think about it, it makes sense. People have been in their houses for the last couple of years, and they want to go out and see the world and do different things. But there was a huge growth in aviation, and that put everyone in the industry, both in the agency, the airlines, manufacturers, in the position of needing to rapidly staff up. And so one of the questions that, you know, people have expressed some concern about is, have we lost a lot of experience as a result of COVID, and we're just going through an inevitable training and experience cycle to bring back the level of experience that you have? The other thing, too, is with all the traffic that we've had growing, it does strain the capacity of the system to handle it. Everyone wants to fly at the same time. Yeah, sure, there's a lot of capacity in the middle of the night, but that's not when you and I are interested in taking a flight. So it's a variety of different factors, but it's very safe.
Let's focus on some of the specific challenges. Let's start by talking about personnel challenges in the air traffic controller system. To what extent are we seeing something that is really the grandchild of what happened during the Reagan administration?
Well, that was the beginning of the challenges that we have. Those of us of a certain age will recall that Ronald Reagan fired the air traffic controllers and really went after their union, a union called PATCO, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, in 1981. They were all fired. And so that meant that in 1981, too, a whole lot of young controllers were hired all at once. Now, controllers have a mandatory retirement age at 56. So go forward 35 years from 1981, and that was the first, you know, challenge that we saw in terms of a large number of retirements across the system and needing to hire up to replace them. Second thing that we saw was COVID. You know, I mentioned a lot of people that had gone ahead and retired during COVID, and that also increased the challenge of hiring more controllers across the system. And this is not a job that you can just hire somebody off the street and put them on the boards and the next day they're, you know, moving airplanes. You know, this is a couple to 3 years, depending on the facility that they're operating within. It is a great job. It does not require a college degree. It's one of the best jobs you can get with a high school diploma. And the FAA, you know, is responsible for all of the training. But one of the challenges that it's having to deal with is really to hit its hiring targets in order to ensure that we have adequate controllers to do the job that needs to be done.
So now, is there a training program before they get those 2 or 3 years?
Yeah.
And how's it work?
Well, so a person is hired and they go to the FAA Academy. The FAA Academy is in Oklahoma City, and they get their initial training there. And then they will move from there to facilities. And what I mean by a facility is a TRACON, a Terminal Radar Approach Control Facility, an air traffic control tower, a center where they handle the high altitude traffic. And then they will have on the job training that is being done by other experienced controllers while they're in that facility. And each one has very unique requirements and challenges with respect to the airspace that it has, that it manages, the type of traffic that it has. Like New York Center, which is physically the smallest amount of airspace, is actually the most complex. The largest airspace controlled by an air traffic center is right here at Salt Lake Center.
No kidding.
Yeah.
So would that be the people who do flight following, or they hand off from departure?
No, it will get passed along throughout the course of the flight. And so you will first check in if you're going to depart on your flight with the tower. And there may be what's called a ramp tower, which might be run by the airport or the airline that's going to control when you can push back from the gate. But you cross a line, and then you're under the control of FAA air traffic control. They will give you instructions to taxi out. and that's called the ground controller, and they will turn you over to the local controller who will clear you to depart. And then once you're off the ground, you get turned over to the TRACON, who is going to take you out for several, you know, for a number of miles, and then they will turn you over to the center. You will be passed, depending on how long your flight is, to multiple centers. And if you are like me and listen to air traffic control, you might, you know, remember hearing things like, you know, check in with Salt Lake Center, you know, and then they give you a different radio frequency, call Denver Center on this frequency. And then, and there is a handshake that controllers, you know, a technical handshake that they have to ensure that the aircraft is always under positive control.
There's a lot.
Yeah.
Now, I believe there's a movie that depicted this as being extraordinarily stressful.
Pushing tin.
An extraordinarily stressful job. Is it, do you think that reasonably captured it? I mean, you also pointed out that they have to retire in their 50s, but pilots can fly into their 60s. Mm-hmm. Why is that? And do you think it is that stressful?
Well, it is. You have to be on top of your game. You have to. I actually took the air traffic controller exam. I did. I won't say I aced it, but I did pass. And because what you're looking for is an ability to be decisive, to respond quickly, to see patterns that are developing in the airspace, and you know, and you have to be on your game every day. And this is actually one of the challenges right now because of the shortages of controllers. Controllers are working a lot of overtime, and so there are very genuine concerns about controller fatigue. As the numbers are growing slowly to where they need to grow. Now, the FAA has done a number of things to try to increase the hiring pipeline. Like, for example, they've entered into agreements with college training programs to take up a lot of that training burden. So that takes a lot of the pressure off Oklahoma City. You know, I chaired a review committee that looked at controller hiring a couple of years ago, and one of the things that was surprising to me is they used as the principal constraint on hiring the capacity of the academy, which doesn't make sense.
No.
You know, you need to figure out what is the number you need and then figure out what's the best way to get it. And they're doing a lot of that now.
Jeez. So do, let's say someone is trying to become a commercial pilot. They're doing their private pilot and getting their hours. Would it behoove someone to get a job as a controller? I mean, is it something someone can jump into for 5-6 years?
There is a huge debate about that across the industry. I think it is, I don't know that it is necessary for someone to be a controller, but it is important that pilots and controllers each have a very good understanding of the world that they operate within. And so there have been programs over the years where controllers can actually fly in the jump seat and actually understand what, you know, what it sounds like from, as they say it, that side of the frequency.
Yeah.
And what the pilots are dealing with. Pilots will regularly visit air traffic facilities and oftentimes will just take the time to get to know controllers that they talk to all the time and, you know, and understand the working conditions that they operate under. So I think there is a lot of benefit if they each understand what the other is dealing with on a day-to-day basis.
So do you think a lot of Delta pilots pop in and see the Salt Lake men and women at the air traffic control just so they recognize their voice?
I don't know if it's a lot, but I know there are some.
Yeah, I know. I got my private pilots in Southern California years ago.
Yeah.
And my instructor said, come on, we're going in. We're going to meet the voices that you hear on the radio.
Sure.
They were fantastic. All of them were so helpful. Treat them with respect. Yeah, I got a lot of help from air traffic control.
Well, and they're very proud of what they do. And the fact that, you know, it's a really high stress job, but they're able to manage it in a way that ensures the safety of the system. And there are, you know, they have a lot of people that are looking out for one another in a facility as well.
Yeah, I imagine you can't be an air traffic controller and have the slightest bit of a cold or be on cold medicine or anything like that, because you have to, as you said, right on your game. You can't pause for 5 seconds.
Like a pilot, you have to have a medical certification, and there are certain drugs that you cannot take if you're on duty.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And is NyQuil, DayQuil one of those?
Probably, but I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
I wonder.
The other thing we see in the popular press a lot is complaints about the technology that that supports the system. And you see articles that say, oh, this is hasn't been changed for 40 years and people have been trying to fix it. And you mentioned that one of the things that you were looking at when you were brought on was to look at that. Let's sort of review the technology and where it stands and what challenges you see.
Yeah, well, there is some very old technology. There is also a lot of not so old technology. The platforms that the controllers use, think of the screen they're looking at when they are moving airplanes. Those, in the scheme of things, are relatively new. Those were the Enroute system. It's a system called ERAM. That was first deployed in 2013, 2014. The program that works in the terminal environment, that's approach control, and in the towers, that's a system called STARS. It's a little bit older, but it was deployed, you know, roughly along the same timetable. Now, it receives a lot of information from radar. A lot of those are really, really old. But they're incredibly durable, they're incredibly reliable. And I don't know if there's necessarily a problem with an old radar. They, you know, they do the job and do it well. Now, more recently, we've deployed GPS systems, and that, you know, radar and GPS are both what are called surveillance systems, and that gives the controller a view of what's going on across the system. And those systems are largely fused together on the platforms, and the GPS systems are relatively newer. Those date back to the early 2000s. And the agency has been going through a refresh, you know, a process to refresh that. There's a big problem with the buildings that a lot of these facilities operate within. You know, I mentioned the centers. There are 21 of them in the United States. Each of those buildings is more than 50 years old. And so just think about that, the HVAC systems, the, you know, the electrical systems, and so on down the line. And then all of this stuff is tied together with a network of wires and fiber and all of that that networks everything together. And that, a lot of that is quite old. I mean, sort of like the internet here in Park City, a lot of copper wire. But, you know, there is some that's also fiber-based. Why is it this way? At the end of the day, it's a funding issue. You know, the agency has had largely flat capital funding, certainly when I was at the agency and even continuing since then. And so I think that's why the industry is so excited about the administration's commitment and desire to make some significant investments in the air traffic technology.
And what kinds of things do you think they will or should be doing?
Well, you know, the first thing they got to look at is that network infrastructure. You know, that's what I think is probably the most important. That's underpinning a lot of the problems that we've seen at Newark. And but I think that, I mentioned the review that we did a couple of years ago. We had actually identified this telecom network as a big issue that was floating out there because a lot of the technology was no longer going to be supported by the vendors that provided it. And so, but
ouch.
Yes, but you know, what it means is you have to resource the agency in a way that they have what they need to migrate through those transitions. And so, you know, you have what is the funding level? That's one problem. But a second problem is the funding uncertainty. I was in the agency for 7.5 years. I never started a fiscal year with my budget in place. You know, it was...
Because it hadn't been appropriated?
It hadn't been appropriated, or in some years we'd have a shutdown, or two or three, or 25. Or we might have a short-term extension, which basically means that you're held at the previous year's levels. And so if you start out with a flat budget, but then you don't have any certainty until halfway through the year... You're not in a position where you can enter into long-term contracts or commission long-term activities that you need to make this happen. And so this gets back to this point that I was raising earlier. And this is all because the FAA is subject to appropriations, even though it is funded with excise taxes.
So I imagine each of those centers you were just mentioning has a different internet service provider that they have to use, and you don't know if they're up to date with their cabling or fiber.
Well, they tend to have a national network,
okay,
you know, for that kind of stuff. The bigger issue is, you know, just the characteristics of the different buildings. Like Minneapolis Center, it's built in an area where the building has to constantly deal with subsidence and water intrusion, you know, into the facility. This is one that I remember spending.
That's not a reassuring image. You know,
yeah. But the other thing, too, that I think that it's important to understand is we built 21 centers at a time when technology was very different. There's nobody on the planet that thinks we need 21 centers today. We don't have to replace all 21. Technology has evolved to a place now where we could probably operate the same amount of airspace with a much smaller number.
That's interesting.
But that brings with it a whole host of political problems. Think about, you know, how Congress thinks of military bases.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this is the same thing.
Yeah.
So you mentioned Newark. Can you sort of explain why you think the big problems have developed at Newark?
Okay, well, Newark is one of the three New York airports that operates in a consolidated terminal radar approach control facility. And historically, that facility has been located on Long Island. It provided TRACON services to Newark, to JFK and LaGuardia airports. Problem with Long Island is it's a very expensive place to live. And so the FAA always had a hard time attracting people to work out there, particularly younger controllers. It's kind of one thing if you're from there, your family's there, and you're kind of used to that. But if you're moving in from someplace different, I mean, you deal with a lot of sticker shock. And yes, controllers get locality pay. They get, you know, a little subsidy, you know, based on where they live, but it's not anywhere near what some would argue it needs to be in a place like Long Island. So what the FAA made a decision to do was to relocate the Newark sector to a TRACON facility in Philadelphia. The thought was that it made sense both for geographic reasons, you know, because Philadelphia TRACON controls Philadelphia Airport, you know, both in New Jersey and the other, you know, facilities across the state there. It would be easier to hire and so on down the line. So that decision was made, I want to say, a little over a year ago. What they did initially was, you know, I mentioned how all these radars and all these surveillance systems feed into the automation platforms. Well, they were continuing to feed them into Long Island and then running a relay to Philadelphia. And that was, as I understand it, the cheapest and quickest way to make it happen. And what they found was that relay simply didn't work. And so that's where they were seeing, you know, the systems drop out at Newark Airport. And so they have now been working on recreating a modern system where everything feeds directly into Philadelphia. But that was the problem.
So Newark was never actually dangerous. It was just a bit of a slowdown.
Well, it's never good if you lose your screen. And, you know, you've heard things from a few seconds to maybe as long as 90 seconds. That's not a good situation. But the way controllers deal with loss of critical systems is they take a penalty on efficiency. And so you move aircraft farther apart so that you can ensure that you have proper separation standards. And so I think that, and you know, they've also taken a penalty on efficiency as it relates to, you know, just being able to manage traffic to available staffing. So, you know, it's a long-term problem, but, you know, the agency is making progress, but it takes a while to get people trained and hired.
Yeah. So there's also a few issues of personnel challenges in the cockpit. At one point, the majority of pilots were ex-military. How has that changed, and what are the implications for air safety?
Well, the Air Force has, and the Navy have also changed. And I mean, the industry still does get a lot of pilots from the military, but not in the numbers we would get during the Cold War. And also the military's own mission has evolved to more drone pilots and so forth, which is a completely different training regime and not...
Doesn't really supply pilots for commercial airlines.
No. Commercial airlines like pilots on the flight deck.
I imagine they would. So yeah. there are far more drone pilots than... let's say fighter jet or transport jet pilots.
I don't know what is the maximum number, but it has had an impact on pilots that have been available to transition to the commercial industry.
Yeah.
If you're not training as a military pilot, then you're looking at a relatively expensive training regimen to become a pilot. Now, what the airlines have done is they've launched their own programs where, they will, Delta's program is called Propel. United has one called Aviate, where they will select a class of younger pilots that they want to move through the system. And what it does is a couple of things. It gives them line of sight to the job they could have in the commercial airline and, provides kind of a path for somebody as they go through training. They have an understanding that there's going to be something on the end of that rainbow.
Go ahead.
We all have this image. There was a certain reassuring element of getting into a commercial airliner 20 years ago and hearing the pilot come on, and he sounded like Chuck Yeager, right? He had this military clipped cadence, and you had the sense that, wow, the person flying this plane, they used to fly fighter pilots, they're equipped for any emergency, they're agile, they're adept, they're all over it. To what extent, and you sort of wonder, the ones who go through a purely commercial training program, do they get the number of hours, do they get the number of threats? Do you think that they're as capable?
No, there is no difference in terms of what the standards or requirements are. To hold an air transport pilot certificate, you have to have a minimum of 1,500 hours to fly in either the left or the right seat here in the United States. That is a higher standard than anywhere else in the world. Now, there is a belief that perhaps among some in the industry that certainly for the first officer, a lower number might make sense. And then there are companies that are also exploring not just the number of hours, but the quality of hours. Because you can get those 1,500 hours towing a banner on the beach. You're not really learning a whole lot about commercial aviation. But if we could, there are now very high fidelity simulators produced at much lower cost where you could simulate the conditions of an actual accident and train the pilots on how to recover from it. And so, I think it's very exciting what these opportunities represent. And I think it will only improve training. Like I said, we have the highest standard already, but that doesn't mean we're going to sit back on our laurels and say, we've got it covered. There's always more we can do.
And keep making the training better and better and making the whole thing safer.
Exactly.
Is the pilot pipeline robust at this point? Are the airlines able to hire what they need?
It's getting to the point where, it's getting to a better point. Like in where we had the biggest problem were the regional airlines. Because, the regionals, think of SkyWest. Somebody would come into SkyWest, as soon as the spot opened up at Delta, they had their hours, boom. They were going to jump over there. And so it put the regionals in a constant training regimen. And I think that that's finally now starting to stabilize a little bit. It's costing everyone a lot of money to ensure that the training is carried out. But I think that, we went through with COVID a big wave of retirements, and I think we're only now just starting to come out of that.
Gee, so a pilot, if they get their 1,500 hours, they'd get a job with SkyWest, first a regional airline?
Yeah.
Are the hours less for that because
No, if they're flying passengers for hire,
it's 1,500.
Yeah.
Gotcha. I would think so. It makes it just by the way you say that, where they would then go to Delta, makes me a little wary about SkyWest or something.
No, it's SkyWest is an incredibly well-run airline.
Yeah.
And they provide services not just for Delta, but also Alaska, United. And they, I actually, when I was the administrator, visited them in St. George. Sort of had the impression I was the first one that had ever done that. but I was incredibly impressed with their team and their program there.
Now, we've seen some ground incidents over the last few months. Any thought, does it just seem like there's more of them, or are there in fact more of them, and why do you think that is?
Well, I think we're in a bit of a media vortex right now where everything is getting reported, even if it might not have been reported in the past. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the number of incidents, they're roughly what you would have seen in previous years. Now, the FAA divides incidents by seriousness, and there was, early on, there was a concern of the number of more serious incidents. But I think that they've done a lot of focus on training and a lot of focus on technology. The technology is, it takes us back to the money issue. Mm. The two most useful things that you can have are ground surveillance technologies that controllers can see and will alert them if there is an imminent collision or clip that is going to take place there. It's not deployed at every airport. And the reason is the agency doesn't have the money. And so if you don't have the money, you obviously can't do it. The other is the use of tower simulators. The FAA has invested a fair amount of money in sims. The challenge of using simulators is that the trainers are rated controllers. And so for every hour they're doing training, they're not controlling airplanes. And so, the training issue, also depends on having a robust school of controllers.
Now, do you run into issues with, you have commercial pilots, you have commercial aviation sharing an airport with general aviation, mm-hmm. and maybe you have your captain with, 5,000 hours. And then there's a runway incursion with a little single engine, and the person has 75 hours. Is that a common thing? Is that, that I imagine would be pilot error, not necessarily controller error.
Yeah. In general aviation has a higher incident rate than commercial aviation. In commercial aviation, our fatality rate is virtually zero. Aviation, it's still very, very low, but we do have fatalities in general aviation, and the vast majority of them are pilot error.
We've talked about technology, and we've focused on the FAA side. I do want to just take a minute and talk about the technology challenges faced by the airlines, and in particular, when you see something like the CrowdStrike incident, which you might want to explain a little bit, to what extent is this system or these systems vulnerable, just like other systems in our society?
Well, I think that the CrowdStrike incident from last year was, essentially the CrowdStrike was hired by the airlines, and Delta was the most affected by it, to provide security. And I think what has been reported and what is well known is they loaded a software patch that had not been fully tested. And that had the effect of bringing the entire system down. And it took a long time to recover. Delta in particular is very heavily Windows-based. And so this is why it was probably affected to the extent that Delta was. And Delta's, it's in the courts right now, and it will be resolved. I think Delta feels very confident in the position that they've taken. But what it does illustrate is there is no one in this industry that provides all of these systems themselves.
Ah.
They are relying on vendors and partners to provide certain critical systems. And so when you put it all together, now Delta has a lot, and I think all the airlines have, a lot of systems that minimize what your partners have access to. I think what made CrowdStrike a little bit different is this company was hired to provide security.
Yeah.
And it turned out that it was their system that represented the security problem.
So if there's some coders out there, some of our listeners might have a startup software company, what do the airlines need? What would that person out there, you know, coding away all day long, what could they design to help the whole system?
I see it breaking into two buckets. All the airlines are trying to distinguish themselves through the customer experience. Mm. You know, Delta has Delta Sync. And, you know, with the free Wi-Fi, where everything links to, you know, you can, if you see half a movie on a flight, you can get on your connection and the movie will pick up right where you left off. And, which is pretty cool.
I didn't know that. Have you tried it?
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. And so, you know, the customer experience is a big part and a focus. On the operations side, the airlines, your biggest non-labor cost is fuel. And so anything that you can do to reduce your fuel burn is quite interesting. And there's a company I work with that has developed a tool that can advise dispatch of an airline of what would be the most efficient route over time. Now, why is that critical? Mm. If you are, let's say you're flying from Los Angeles to New York and you have a big storm in the middle of the country, traditionally what you would do is you would figure every conceivable place that storm could move in that 5 hours from the West Coast to New York. And then you'd fly a big arc around that. Well, technology now enables you to actually fly right at the storm. And when you get closer, you can define exactly what your route is going to be to get around it. And so you burn less fuel, mm-hmm. cost less money. It's a more dynamic environment, but it also doesn't really affect controller workload, because the pilot's not just calling the controller and saying, hey, can you get me a better route? What they're saying instead is, hey, here's where I am. Can you give me this specific route? And for the controller, it's a very easy yes, no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As long as no one else is on that exact route.
Yeah.
So how do you see, to some extent, I read somewhere, I was in a Wall Street Journal article, that, you know, air traffic, the experience of air traffic, hasn't really changed much in 50 years, other than the seats are closer together and it's more crowded. Talk to us about what you see as the major changes in air traffic over the next 10 years. Do you think that the hub and spoke model that the major legacy carriers operate on, will that remain more or less intact?
I don't think the hub and spoke model will dominate things. And we saw this with the bet that Boeing and Airbus placed. Airbus placed the bet on the 380. And, you know, their bet was that you were going to see a further concentration of the hub and spoke model. And then you would fill these monster planes for the very thick legs, between two, very important markets. Boeing made a different bet on the 787. It was a smaller aircraft with long legs that enables them to fly point to point from a larger variety of markets. And I think the market has shown that that's what people want to see. Now, that doesn't mean the death of the hub and spoke, but what it means is as aircraft have evolved, you're really seeing much more of a blend there. The other thing that we're also seeing, and this is really a post-COVID thing, is the growth of premium markets. What we've seen is that particularly younger people, a much higher percentage of them are not looking at the fare as the only deciding factor, when they buy a ticket. They're looking at the experience. And so, and that's what's resulted in airlines, Delta in particular, in segmenting the cabin into different experiences, whether it's Delta One, Premium Select, Delta Comfort, Delta Main. You're trying to respond to the different market segments that are out there. The other thing I think it's also fair to say is that younger people are less interested in acquiring more stuff. Mm-hmm. They're really interested in doing things like travel, doing things like taking advantage of great experiences.
Yeah, I just flew and the airline, I got, you know, I registered for my check-in immediately when it said, you know, I saw the countdown and I got a B, you know, I'm not going to mention the airline, but you know what I'm talking about here. And it wanted me to spend $90 or $80 for each of us to upgrade to A just to get on the plane quicker.
Oh, geez.
And are people paying this kind of stuff?
Well, some people are.
To get on the plane quicker. Yeah. Last thing I want to do is be on that plane.
I would imagine that it's probably attractive to, like, a family, you know, where they want to get everyone together.
Yeah, but families usually get pre-board.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
All right, we got about a minute left. Real quickly, are we going to see electric airplanes? And are we going to see commercial airlines flying electric planes in our lifetime?
Yes.
Okay.
Even with the weight of the batteries?
Yes. Now, you're not going to see it on a coast-to-coast flight in the near term. Delta has invested in a company called Joby Aviation. They're based out in Santa Cruz, California. You can go to jobyaviation.com, and you can actually see the aircraft flying. But the partnership between Delta and Joby is that it would be an electric vertical takeoff from downtown L.A. to L.A. Airport, downtown New York, or the Manhattan heliports to Kennedy and LaGuardia Airport. And, you know, take that hour-long trip and turn it into 10 minutes.
All right. Yeah, I remember seeing the Pan Am helicopters and such in New York.
But what's great about Joby, there's not the noise.
There you go.
We've had a wonderful conversation with Michael Huerta, former administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration. Thanks so much for spending time with us. We'll be right back after this. For some people in the Park City community, the best holiday of the year is Miner's Day. This year's Miner's Day celebration is coming up September 1. Here to talk about the Miner's Day celebration and some potential sponsorship for the famous running of the balls, we have Barry Nan Cohen Rothschild and Mark Brown. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Barry Nan, fill us in. What's this Miner's Day thing all about?
A Miner's Day is a wonderful way for our community to celebrate what everybody else calls Labor Day. And we're celebrating the original laborers of this town, the miners, and all of the history that comes along with that.
Okay, and what are some of the events that you'll see on a Miner's Day celebration?
So some of the events you're going to see is there's a wonderful parade, but before the parade, we have a very fun tradition where we drop thousands of balls out of a particular little hatch that was developed recently. We had one for a long time that was maybe a little bit less advanced technologically, but we got a really great new tower. There's a wonderful ball drop, a tunnel where our Rotary Interact Club kids from the high school are in the track where the balls go, and they run ahead of it, kind of like the running of the bulls, except these are golf balls that people have purchased for an opportunity to win prizes, and all the donations go to Park City Rotary's Community Grants and Scholarship Program. It's really fun.
And what kind of prizes have you been able to line up this year?
I don't know the prizes this year, but typically we get some day passes to Deer Valley and to Park City, and we sometimes I think even get a season pass. We get dining gift certificates. We get experience gift certificates. We get products from local vendors, all sorts of stuff that is all donated to support this event.
And those balls will go on sale, I assume, sometime in August?
They do. They go on sale at the beginning of August, and we sell right up to almost the last second before we are dropping the balls.
And how many balls, Mark, do you know how many balls we're going to drop this year?
I think they're going to be 12,000.
12,000 golf balls. And who writes all the numbers on all those balls?
We do. There's a gathering of Park City Rotarians writing the numbers.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun.
And there might be some beer involved.
Okay. One of the things that has to happens on Miner's Day is, Mark, I know that you're involved with finding sponsors to sort of support the effort. Can
Yes.
you explain a little bit about that?
Yes. So there are various levels of sponsorship available. So, for example, at the lowest level, the $1,000 level, you get one of the track panels on the running of the balls track, so you get that visual exposure. You get a website placement on the sponsor page on the website. You get a social media feature where you're on the sponsor page, and you get local radio and newspaper recognition as well. There's a full-page ad that runs in the Park Record, for instance. At the $10,000 level, You get 10 track panels on the ball track. You get 4 panels on the tower banner, because at the levels above $1,000, you actually get a banner on the track tower from which the balls are released. You get website placement on the homepage. You get 3 solo spots on social media, and you get prominent featuring on those newspaper and radio ads as well. So depending on your level, you get a certain amount of exposure. We have a lot of repeat sponsors who like coming back every year to sponsor. I think it's a combination of supporting the community, but also it's what they get, because they get the things that I just mentioned. They get a lot of audio recognition as well, because during the day, our announcers are constantly reading the names of the various sponsors. So you've got thousands of people on Main Street seeing the track panels, seeing the banners on the ball tower, and hearing these sponsors' names read pretty constantly throughout the morning. There's one more sponsorship level I want to mention as well, which is we now do a special ball run of $100 balls before the main run, and there's only 150 of those. And we're looking for someone to sponsor that at the $3,000 level.
And that was who sponsored that last year?
We didn't have a sponsor last year. The year before, it was Manscaped, who does men's grooming, shall we say.
But that sponsorship opportunity will obviously get a lot of singular publicity, because it is unique.
Absolutely. Because, okay. You've got people focused on these $100 balls, and it's just that sponsor, being named during that run, and there's a lot of excitement. So it's a very good opportunity.
And the nice thing about being able to sell sponsorship opportunities for those panels is there's lots of room for them as we go down that track.
Yes.
And so I assume you have plenty of supply left.
We do have room left, yes.
Okay, and if people want to reach out to you, Mark, to find out about how to engage in these sponsorships, how do they do that?
Okay, there are 3 ways. One is they can just simply go to the parkcityminersday.org website, which has all the information, but there's also my email, markbrown392@gmail.com, or they can call my cell, 435-901-7155. Happy to talk with anybody about the different sponsorship levels.
Okay, Berenann, anything else you want to add before we go?
No, the one thing I will add is that absolutely these sponsorships allow 100% of the ball purchase donations to go directly into our scholarship fund in the community and our grants. And I think it's a really special thing to be able to make an investment of even $20 towards that. So buy your balls, buy your sponsorships, and we're excited about it.
Berenann Cohen-Rothschild and Mark Brown, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
We'll be right
thanks
back.
Thanks for having us, Roger.
All right, we'll be right back after this.